what has worked and what hasn't worked. So I know those fears are valid, but I want folks to remember the data to support that 5%, that number nationally. It's an important number to remember, but it's something that we can plan for. So what I am really excited about in terms of doing up this space is taking out that 95% of the police department as soon as possible, investing in communities that actually get us the results and the responses that we need, and dreaming up this new system. You have to dream, but you can't let that dream stop if you're not willing to defund. So from my perspective, I just want those folks to do some research, to learn a little bit more about not just those national statistics, but also locally in terms of how our police, in terms of the data, in terms of how effective they are in solving those places. Yeah, I would like our society to see those values of community care reflected in all aspects.
I would like to give you the space. Let me know if there's anything that we haven't touched on that you would like to talk about.
Yeah, thank you for that. I would say, just in short, that I'm looking for, and I keep saying visioning and dreaming, but I do want, you know, Oregonians to realize that we can dream of something better together. And I'm looking forward to the investment that is needed for us to dream and to do that work effectively. We're going to need to have some substantial changes in the way that we understand public safety. One that has the intention of care and the intention of restorative justice, that practices restorative justice and safety without that violence, without that fear. Folks that I talk to, you know, around this.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Labor Radio. I am Michael Cathcart.
And I'm Elliot Gilliland.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. For this episode, we would like to start off by expressing our solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement. And for our part, we are going to examine how we got here and where police unions fit into the larger labor movement.
Yeah, obviously we stand in solidarity with all of the protests going on right now across the United States. Thank you so much to everyone engaging in this really, really important movement that's happening. But for us on Labor Radio, I think it's really important to give some kind of backstory, how we got here as a United States of America and, you know, the role that police unions played in it, because I think we'll see in a minute here that it was quite large. One thing I think we do want to call out, too, is that it's really important right now that everyone takes this opportunity to expand their kind of normal information and online engagement patterns.
Yes.
And by that, I mean, I think it's really, really, really critical that people find more Black voices online. And engage with different culture and different ideas and opinions than perhaps they normally would find in either, you know, kind of their echo chambers or their bubble. And please, if you can, we really want to make sure to, you know, urge people to donate to, you know, organizations like the National Bail Fund, mm-hmm. The Know Your Rights Camp,
yep.
Or even the NAACP or the ALCU.
Yeah. And here in Portland, you know, Don't Shoot PDX is another great organization to follow, you know, get behind and learn more about. So, yeah, with all that said, because this is Labor Radio, we are going to look at sort of the labor connection to the movement that's happening right now. Obviously, if you have, unless you've been living under a rock for the past few weeks, it's been unavoidable. You have seen video footage, you've heard accounts, you've seen news stories about what has been happening in the streets. You know, what we've seen over the last few weeks is a police riot, plain and simple. The inexplicable response of the nation's police forces to peaceful protests against their own brutality just further proves the point being made by the protesters. And it seems that, you know, largely the police, they're lashing out in violence because they see the writing on the wall and they believe that if they can't apply enough force to squash this protest movement that has sprung up, then real change is in store for them. And that, you know, that may entail funding cuts, an end to their impunity and to their authority, a shrinking scope of their responsibilities, and, you know, going even as far as potentially losing their right to carry weapons, you know, or militarized equipment, or potentially even losing their jobs or disbanding police forces altogether, you know, in certain cases. So it does seem like, you know, if you just look at the videos of it and you understand what the movement is saying, it's pretty insane to think that the police would respond to peaceful protests calling out their brutality with more increased brutality at an even faster rate than we've seen before. But if you take into context what is potentially at stake for them and what you what they may be thinking, it sort of makes sense why they would act this way. It's not, I mean, it doesn't make sense and it doesn't justify it, but from a very twisted perspective, you can understand why they would do that. And so I think to understand all of that, we do need to talk about the origins of policing in this country. And so that's, you know, there's a lot of misconceptions about where police come from.
Right. This is all kind of kicked off from basically the murder of George Floyd.
Right.
You know, by kind of an over-aggressive group of police officers. Right. Because there was more than just the one that was basically sitting on his neck and suffocating him.
Right.
But I think it's important to call out that this is just the latest version of this. And this has been going on since basically creation of whatever kind of police department, whatever you know the early versions of which you can call different things, but
right.
This is just the latest version, right? And we've had many different versions of this protest, and hopefully this moves kind of the reformation or kind of the recreation of the system forward in a little bit of a better way. But again, this has been going on for some time. So how did we get here?
Yeah.
During the first half of the 19th century, police associations existed, but they remained fairly small. Many states actually made it illegal in some form or another for police officers to actually unionize, right? And so city governments mostly feared negative political repercussions or unadvantageous negotiating positions against, you know, what they saw as somewhat of a, you know, it's public, but, you know, a kind of a violent force controlling the status quo that if they lost control of could go quite poorly.
Right.
But a lot of that started to change in the 1950s and 60s. And the reason for that is there were obviously many things going on there from a civil rights standpoint. And many political reformers entered the scene to cut back on police corruption, especially in poor and minority communities. Right. So there, you know, we've all seen kind of, what was going on during the civil rights movement. And in a lot of places, unions actually won recognition and collective bargaining rights, right, in protest of a lot of these political reforms. And they did so using much of the anti-police rhetoric that you see today, which we'll talk about more later. But kind of basically saying if there are no police, then no one's safe, you know, that kind of thing. And
right.
Labeling people as soft on crime.
Yeah.
Right. That was kind of the beginnings of that, though. You know, we saw a little bit earlier as well.
Yeah.
The funny part of that is that most of the political reformers weren't actually anti-police. They actually thought that the changes would, in fact, help the police do a better job, right? Like keeping people accountable, making sure that there are standards and best practices, all of these things, which we'll get into, across other environments are deemed as necessary and important. But for some reason, that wasn't seen here. So the police unions basically in the 50s and 60s very aggressively opposed these measures. And in the case of like the city of Philadelphia, even removed a bunch of civilian oversight that had been won kind of previously under a pretty left-leaning mayor who wanted to kind of create some reform there. Over the last 5 years, as part of demands for reform have mounted again, right? So like in the aftermath of the police violence in, you know, Ferguson and Baltimore and now in Minneapolis with George Floyd, police unions have emerged as one of the most significant roadblocks to change.
Right.
I think it's really important to call out, too, that, you know, over the many years of this show, Labor Radio has made a point to call out the kind of union rates that have dropped across the country, right? And it's really important to us because, you know, the less amount of kind of unionized workers puts more power in the hands of businesses and doesn't allow people to collectively bargain from a position of strength.
Right.
But as opposed to almost every other industry, while police unions haven't grown dramatically, they haven't shrunk nearly as much as, you know, all of the other
every other
yeah. industry. So I think that's really important to call out because it gives them a ton of power and authority over local politics. When Steve Fletcher, a Minneapolis city councilman and frequent police department critic, sought to divert money away from hiring officers and actually towards a newly created Office of Violence Prevention, he basically said that the police stopped responding as quickly to 911 calls placed to his constituents.
Right.
And I think that right there is just one example of some of the tactics that we'll get into that are used by these very large and fairly powerful police unions who have grown dramatically, you know, since the early part of the 19th century.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, yeah, it is important to draw a distinction, like wherein obviously we believe, or at least I personally believe, that every worker has the should have the right to unionize. And that is an essential part of working in this country, in this economy. There is a stark difference between the vast majority of unionized workplaces and what it is to be a police officer, law enforcement officer. And that means that the role of the union, although it may be, you know, ostensibly the same thing across, you know, whether you are a truck driver or a construction worker or a police officer, what the union does to protect their workers has much far, much more far-reaching consequences when it is in regard to those who carry out law enforcement.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important to call out, you know, we earlier last year, we called out the huge victory that the Chicago Teachers Union had over the city in terms of, you know, the long-term kind of foresight that they used in their collectively bargained deal.
Yeah.
And a lot of that involved, you know, like stopping different kind of privatized versions of education, despite the fact that they have privatized teachers, you know, in their union.
Yeah.
You know, it also involved in, you know, making sure that there were nurses and different class sizes. These are all things that aren't just about wages and time off and a lot of the things that people claim unions are all about. And to me, one of the biggest differences, right, is that the Chicago's teacher union or any other teacher's union isn't going to use its power to stop investigations or protect its members who abuse their power.
Right.
Right. So I think for us, it's really important to do to note the things that it's very important that a union do and other things that it seems like a police union might try to do. Right. So police unions can actually be so effective at defending their members that even cops with like a pattern or a history of abuse can't be touched. So in 2014, after the killing of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald by Officer Jason Van Dyke, it emerged that Van Dyke had been the subject of multiple complaints already, but basically a code of silence about misconduct was effectively baked into the labor agreement between the police unions and the city, according to one task force that conducted an investigation, right?
Yeah.
So I think these things are kind of, I think that's a very good way to put it, is that they're baked into a lot of the reforms that the police unions have created, maybe not necessarily in good faith.
Exactly. And on top of that, like, it's hard to divorce the role that police and therefore the police unions play within the larger political structure of any given city, you know, or county or whatever it is. You know, whereas, yeah, again, if we were talking about a union representing warehouse workers or something like that, there is no symbiotic relationship between those workers and maybe the local DA or the elected mayor or anything like that. They are simply representing their own workers in that workspace. But the unions for police officers, because of the role or the connection between the police officers and the people who carry out the law on the other side, you know, district attorneys, and then, of course, elected officials like mayors and city councilors, because they are all part of one larger legal system within that city, within that community, there is a sort of blurring of lines or a leverage that can be wielded unnecessarily powerfully by the union for police officers that is not the same that you would see for any other workplace union.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
And when you have this super powerful entity that is feeling attacked, right? Because I think we've seen over the last several years is that police unions are retreating farther deeper into their positions as opposed to having a discussion or trying to solve any of these things. So basically, as critics of the police get louder and more mainstream, union members have actually started to elect more aggressive leaders. So actually, before all of the, you know, basically before George Floyd's murder, excuse me, in Minneapolis in 2015, Bob Kroll, who you might have heard, was elected. Bob Kroll is one of the largest opponents of change, basically, to police regulation in the news right now. And he, in 2015, defeated the union's longest term president by nearly 2-1 margin after the city installed basically a police chief who had kind of run on a platform of reform.
Right.
So I think there is like a primary example of, instead of kind of having these conversations, a lot of the time what's happening is there's a retreatment. And similarly to, you know, how the country seems more divided, you hear people say that than it's ever been. A lot of, you know, left-leaning people retreating into left-leaning positions and echo chambers, and right-leaning people doing the same. I think you're seeing here a case of police unions and police officers and its members retreating back to their positions and basically fighting the, you know, the reform from such a powerful position because their member bases are so huge.
Absolutely, yeah. And because they are in basically every city across the country, the only public services that continue to see increased budgets, whereas most other services, you know, public sector workers, they see their budgets slashed or reduced. That does continue to give more and more leverage to these, to the police unions, because they continue to get the funding, the support, and because largely, you know, people... you know, like America is largely a conservative country in a lot of ways, and if you, mm-hmm. as a politician, it's a lot more difficult to get elected on a position of being anti-police or like
yeah.
pro-reduction of police, and therefore politicians are largely beholden to the desires of police forces.
Well, yeah, I mean, and you know, the right-wing movement of the last 20 or so years, you know, plays a big role in this, in that kind of the hard and fast black and white, no gray area. You know, messaging is really effective and has clearly worked on multiple occasions. And the ability to call out a local politician on, you know, being soft on crime or, you know, not caring about these things, it's very easy, right? Because a lot of the time the stats are more hidden, right? Stopping crime, saying that there were, you know, saying that there were less, you know, like felonies or misdemeanors or whatever in an area or a county is a lot easier to do than kind of looking deeper than that and seeing like what that caused, right? Like it's really easy to on the surface look at something like stop and frisk as like, you know, someone who's not paying attention and go, oh, this is a good thing, when you don't see the effect that it has on the people and the culture and the communities and the kind of devastation that it creates. You know, I think, you know, you're going to, we'll touch on it later in the show, but, you know, defund the police, many people have heard about it, is a movement that's, you know, progressives are kind of putting forward and leftists as well. You know, I think it's really important to remember that, you know, a lot of this stuff has been conditioned in us, right? Like up in most cases, if you're being robbed, like the police officer isn't there hiding and stopping it from happening right. in the first place, right? A lot of this stuff is societal and, you know, shifting some of this money around to perhaps help the mental health or people who are getting into these situations. The police aren't stopping anything from happening other than through the fear of the repercussions,
yeah, exactly.
which would exist without, you know, because like I said, a cop's not going to jump out of a trash can hiding by your house and stopping someone breaking in. So I think it's important to stop and think about some of the ways that we've been conditioned to think about these things.
Absolutely. And like, you know, right now we have a situation in this country where police, you know, we basically have one tool and then it's a hammer, and we use that hammer for every problem that a city encounters. So if you, you know, if you have someone, whether it is, you know, dealing with an instance of crime, the police show up. If it's dealing with, you know, someone having a mental health crisis, the police show up. If it's dealing with a domestic dispute, the police show up. Like all these different things that realistically are far beyond the scope of what a police officer is trained for, or even, you know, someone showing up with a weapon is the right person to be showing up for that. Like that is the only tool we have at this point. And so I think, you know, again, when there's calls, you know, it's a very good slogan because it's simple and it captures it, but it means a large, you know, it encompasses a large body of work. And when people say defund the police, it's not just, well, we don't want police, we want anarchy, but rather like there is a history of long thought out programs that mm-hmm. those funds could be diverted towards that would actually help stem the tide, or, you know, help deal with the causes of a lot of the issues that police are then called to deal with the results of, you know. So I think that it's important for people not to just, as you were saying earlier, to just further entrench themselves in their own silos, their own points of views, but really think beyond just the knee-jerk reaction to what you're hearing from either side and look into what is being called for.
If you're just joining us on Labor Radio, we're discussing basically the you know, the latest kind of protests and discussion that has occurred since the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis earlier this year, the murder, I should say, of George Floyd. And basically, from a labor perspective, the police unions and how they factor in. Right. And one of the things we touched on earlier is why, you know, or we mentioned is that why a police union isn't actually the same as more standard types of other unions.
Yes.
And I think it's really important for us to help, you know, our listeners understand that, because from the surface, it might not seem like that's the case. So I think the biggest difference is that labor unions are focused on empowering working people.
Yes.
Right. And based on a lot of the recent behavior, many police unions can actually be seen disempowering working people.
Absolutely.
So this is not the situation of a union shouldn't exist or different things like that, but it's more of the ultimate goal of the labor movement is to protect workers and laborers.
Yeah.
And if there is a group, regardless of how they are viewed or they exist, if they are threatening or kind of controlling or oppressing the workforce, then that doesn't meet the kind of standards of the labor movement.
Exactly, because, like, I mean, the police, like, if you think about the role of police, like, if there is a strike, police are often the ones who are called out to break that strike, or at least to keep strikers from being able to disrupt workplaces.
Yeah.
Like, the police largely, I mean, at least in the North, in the history of this country, the modern policing grows out of basically the efforts to maintain order and maintain, you know, the capitalist system and keep order within the working class. Like, so if you think about the role that police play in this country now, it's not dissimilar to where they were created. And so, you know, you have a situation where, like, police, although they are technically working class and they are unionized, they are basically a barrier put in place to keep working class people, or to keep the labor movement in its place, essentially.
And the police unions, by basically making it impossible to initiate reform or hold accountable police forces that are systemically abusing, imprisoning, and terrifying, right, the working people that the labor movement is trying to help, right? A big part of the defund the police movement is actually about taking police unions out of the overall labor movement to empower working people, right? By ensuring that, you know, groups like the AFL-CIO is not forced to represent a slice of the workforce that is structurally opposed to the broader goal of the labor movement, right?
Yeah, you can't have member unions showing up to break strikes of other member unions. You need them acting in solidarity.
Yeah.
That is so police are diametrically opposed to what many other organizations
within in their current form.
Correct.
In their current form.
Yeah.
So I think for us, you know, with the kind of as we come towards the end of the show, I think it's important for us to kind of talk about, like, where we go from here.
Yeah.
What, you know, as we've learned about unions and their role and how strong and powerful police unions have become, I think it's important to talk about how we can remedy the harms police unions have promoted and perpetrated for decades, right?
Absolutely.
Without undermining public sector unionism as a whole, because I think that's really important, right? So
exactly, like, that right now, the one thing to watch out for people within the labor movement is that, like, there is, you know, the right wing has definitely jumped on the bandwagon of, like, well, police unions are bad and therefore we need to eradicate them, we need to deal with them. And that's, you know, that's something to be careful of, because the right wing, there are a number of op-eds that have been coming out, and this has been a call that has been gaining momentum you know, within the last few weeks, and has been in place for a while. But the call to abolish police unions is couched inside a larger demand to
anti-work, anti-labor platform, for sure, right?
So, like, they want to get rid of public sector unions in general, and that is not where this movement should be heading. That's not what that's not ultimately going to deal with. Like, there was an op-ed that came out, I think last week, that basically said, don't blame racism, blame the predictable misconduct of unionized public employees.
Yeah.
Which is just nonsense, because of course you blame racism. It's not just postal workers aren't doing this.
Yeah, right. And, like, I think it's really easy from a top-level point of view to see the many critiques of police unions, like, that they're too powerful, that they bargain for compensation that costs the city too much, or that their interests basically, you know, are contradicted by the public good. That have been levied against them, basically, it's really easy to take those and then point them at people like teachers or nurses or other things like that, right? And so I think for us, it's really important to call out that police unions, like, in many ways are very typical, right? They fight for better wages, for better hours, for basically controls on the management above them to basically not oppress them the same way that we would argue in a food service industry, right? But the work they do is not typical, right?
Correct.
So their basically state-given right to the legal use of violence is not above the public interest and needs to be regulated and limited, right? So until police unions are willing to accept this principle and become accountable for their actions, it's hard for me to see how they can continue to exist in their current form or be a part of the larger labor movement.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, there's a number of things that I think, you know, a number of steps that need to be taken beyond simply regulating police unions. I mean, obviously, this is a systemic issue, and it's not just the role of police within the larger justice system, and it's not just the justice system within the larger socioeconomic system within the United States that needs to be reckoned with. But, you know, right now the focus is on police, and a lot of discussion is around police unions. So a few things that can be done to basically rein in the power of those unions or to curtail it in this moment. You know, there's a lot of things have been put forward, but some of them are putting forward demands that contract negotiations between the cities and their police forces be made public until there is, you know, some, at least for the time being, until a larger plan is put in place to reform police, which, you know, is different than how most unions operate. You know, you usually do not have public presentations of the contract negotiation process. But because of the, as we've been discussing, the role, the power that the police union has over lawmakers, particularly elected lawmakers, and their funding and all that stuff, it does play an undue, you know, the police unions, I think, have undue leverage in their negotiation process with the police to prevent any type of reforms that would be necessary.
Yeah. It kind of makes the case for these things being kind of signed into either federal or state law as opposed to being collectively bargained, because it takes the union's hand out of it. Exactly. And to me, lets them focus on more of the things that a union ought to do.
Exactly.
And like, you know, just speaking a little bit more broadly, basically, like, cities and states need to set standards for the use of force and for reporting and investigating and punishing police abuse, right? In the same way that nurses and teacher unions are both bound by legal standards that are, in fact, integral to their success and widely embraced by their respective groups, police unions have not really been as forthcoming in that manner, right?
Absolutely.
So if there were kind of set standards for analyzing a case of an identified case of abuse, what an investigation looks like, who's involved, who has authority, what are the standard kind of punishments, I think until we have some sort of thing in place that can, you know, actually help police the system, it's kind of hard to move forward.
Right. And yeah, I mean, there's a number of things that do need to be put in place like that. I mean, another thing would be that, along with, you know, making contract negotiations in public and sort of reducing their ability to put their leverage over the negotiation process, also reducing their ability to fund for politicians to accept funds from these police unions.
Yeah.
You know, which is different than most other unions. You know, you do see, at least in the history of the Democratic Party, large donation support from unions, and that, you know, in a certain way is lobbying. But there's a difference when the people who are doing the union that's doing the lobbying is also the one that carries out the laws that they are putting in, you know, they are funding the people, the politicians to come in place and enact. So things like that are important. You know, something as simple as withholding pensions or ensuring that unions do not allow cops, police officers who have been involved in excessive force cases to be rehired, you know, which is against what most union situations are. But in this specific instance, it's far more important that person does not retain their job if they have proven that they are going to use excessive force repeatedly against the public.
Yeah, but again, there are very few cases of other types of unions, again, teachers, nurses, of the union protecting, hiding,
right,
or even, you know, covering up or manipulating data to cover an abusive teacher or abusive nurse or someone abusing their power in one of these professions. So I think,
because,
you know,
that looks poorly on the union as a whole. Whereas police unions don't seem to recognize that.
Again, a lot of the things that a police union is supposed to do is very typical.
Yeah.
But the work that its members conduct is not typical. And so it cannot be treated the same.
Right. And so, yeah, just generally reducing the scope of what that union does to basically maintaining, like, the very, very basic role of a union. Like, maintaining or negotiating benefits, you know, healthcare packages and things like that. dealing with grievances. Like, those are the things that the police union should be involved in, and there should be much less of a public presence for them, much less in the political lobbying side of things, and much less involvement in preventing reforms to their the workplaces of their members. Yeah.
And you know, short of complete police disbandment, the state is always going to have some form of sanctioned violence against the people that inhabit it, right? And I think for us, it should basically be our goal to better understand what that means and regulate it and change the relationship between those inside of the system and those being, quote unquote, like, protected by that force or that sanctioned violence.
Absolutely. Yeah, with that, unfortunately, we are out of time. There's much more that could be discussed in this and will be discussed in the future. Likely, we'll be talking about this again next month. We will be back on with you again in July. But thank you for listening to Labor Radio. Again, I am Michael Cathcart.
And I'm Ellie Gilland.
Have a great day.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon. This is Prison Pipeline. I'm Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. We seek to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safe, healthy, and just society. The House Judiciary Committee held an oversight hearing recently on police practices and law enforcement accountability. We're going to hear some testimony from that on today's show. First, here's Benjamin Crump. He's a civil rights attorney and the founder of the National